Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisek in for Marty Moscowain. The controversy over the hiring of Rutgers University's new athletic director gained fresh fire as some of those on the selection committee said they felt the process was rushed. Those admissions have raised new questions about the decision-making process at the university and the pressures that many schools feel to maximize their athletics programs. Julie Herman has been in the spotlight since allegations of verbal abuse against athletes at another school surfaced last month. Herman has disputed those allegations, and Rutgers president Dr. Robert Barchi has pledged his full support. This hour, we're looking at the most recent developments at Rutgers and what it tells us about the business of college sports. Joining us are Dr. Karen Weaver, professor of sport management at Drexel University and a former coach and athletic director. Dr. Weaver, welcome to Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
And Steve Eder is with us by phone. Steve is a New York Times reporter focusing on college sports. He's written a number of articles about the happenings at Rutgers Athletics Department over the last few months. And Steve, we welcome you to Radio Times.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, Steve, let's begin with this, because this is the most recent story that I've seen that you wrote, and this is about yet another development involving the chief of staff at Rutgers facing a lawsuit. Tell us about that.
Yeah, what we reported today was that, about a little less than a month ago, the president at Rutgers, Robert Barchi, hired a new chief of staff. If you recall, Barchi's term at Rutgers began in the fall last year in September. So he brought in a chief of staff. The chief of staff was hired about a week after the Mike Rice video, the basketball coach video, had surfaced. And this gentleman's name is Gregory Jackson. And he was an administrator at the university. And what we reported today, though, was that Gregory Jackson had been the target of a age discrimination lawsuit filed by Rutgers employees just less than 3 months ago. So our story sort of delves into that lawsuit and also sort of what it says about this this process at Rutgers and the period that they've been going through.
Well, right. So now you have yet another situation of someone being either hired or, in this case, promoted. And some questions about, how is it that if there was knowledge of some problems that this person was now moved into this position, right?
Right. And it sounds familiar to the Rutgers story of what we've been hearing in recent weeks, whether with Julie Herman, but here, certainly Rutgers has come out. They have defended themselves against the allegations that have been made in the lawsuit. And it's clear, too, from Rutgers that, President Barchi was aware of this lawsuit relating to his new chief of staff. And, clearly they felt that he was an appropriate candidate to take on this job, even in light of what's occurred, of late at Rutgers.
Hmm. Well, and speaking of what's occurred of late, suffice it to say it's been a rough couple of months there, certainly with the Julie Herman controversy being just one of the latest. Steve, can you bring us up to speed? Because that's the story that everybody is focused on right now. But, you mentioned the videotape and Mike Rice. There have been a number of issues just since April that have cropped up at Rutgers.
Oh, sure. I mean, this is a story that has came up the first week, the first days of April, ultimately beginning with ESPN airing a 30-minute video, which was essentially a highlight reel of the men's basketball coach at Rutgers, Mike Rice. Images could be seen of him hurling basketballs at players and yelling slurs at them, homophobic slurs at the players. And the video, what was problematic for Rutgers, it turned out, was that the video had been taken to officials at the school, including the athletic director and others, a few months earlier. And back in late November and in December, they had decided to suspend the coach rather than fire him. And once the video came out, went public, went viral, there was an incredible backlash against Rutgers. And that really set off this whole chain of events that we've seen. It led to the resignation of, first the firing of the basketball coach, Mike Rice, then you had the resignation of Tim Pernetti, who was the athletic director, and then incredible scrutiny followed around, the president of the university and what did he know and why didn't he watch the videotape. So that set us up. So we had a period of time after that where, this is all happening over, just less than 2 months, a new basketball coach is brought in, and then there's revelations that the basketball coach hadn't actually graduated from Rutgers, despite claims otherwise. A university biography said that he had graduated from Rutgers, so you can kind of imagine some of the confusion and the, you know, the scrutiny kind of building, and that led us up to the hiring of Julie Herman as athletic director, the new athletic director. And of course, in that case, as we've gotten to hear over the last couple weeks now, that was a May 15th announcement. You know, we've learned about two lawsuits, one at Tennessee and one at Louisville more recently, where she was at the center of lawsuits with claims by coaches at the school. And then, of course, there was the letter by her former players at the University of Tennessee, where there were allegations about mental abuse and anguish among a team that she coached in 1997.
Well, I want to ask you about that, because Rutgers paid a very large sum of money to an executive search firm to help them hire an athletic director. And I'm wondering, was there knowledge of the lawsuits and this letter? Because Julie Herman has said she didn't know about the letter, and it seems that the letter kind of came as a surprise. At least that's what we've been hearing. So I guess the question is, you know, how much did Rutgers know at the time that they hired Julie Herman to become the athletic director?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, here's what was known, to my understanding, is that there were two pieces. The two lawsuits, the Tennessee lawsuit and the Louisville lawsuit, were both, there was a 28-member committee that was impaneled to do as an advisory committee to help advise the president on the hiring of the next athletic director. So those two lawsuits were both on the radar of the people who were involved in hiring Julie Herman. What wasn't known was the existence of the letter by the former players, which, you know, to some it's said that was the most concerning of the allegations, because it's, you know, of course, it's a letter written by actual people that she coached, and the similarities of as someone described it, between the conduct of Mike Rice kind of brought that back up. So that's sort of what we have known about what the committee knew. So they did have quite a bit of information about Julie Herman when they hired her, and they were, you know, aware of some of the concerns, but not all of them.
Hmm. Which, of course, raises the million-dollar question, then, having had knowledge of at least the lawsuits, how do you then move forward, especially as quickly as they did, to make that decision?
We've heard quite a bit from, you know, because this was this large process, there has been criticisms of the process, that it was an unwieldy process. There was emails last week that went around, which we reported on and others did, that where members of the committee had expressed internally, you know, concerns that they didn't have enough time to speak with Julie Herman. They didn't have information about her in a timely manner to be able to, you know, intelligently prepare for their interview with her. And it's you know, so there have been criticisms that have come up of this process, and, you know, still linger out there.
I want to bring Dr. Karen Weaver into our conversation at this point, because you certainly know a thing or two about how these hiring processes are conducted. Was the way that Rutgers did this different from the norm?
Well, we know that they were operating under a self-imposed deadline of June 1st because the co-chair of the search committee indicated he needed to leave the country. So they worked backwards from that. And it appears that they initially called a list of about 70 candidates from the search firm. But I don't think the other co-chair, Kate Sweeney, was happy with the number of women on that list. So she reached out to a national organization called the National Association of Collegiate Women Athletic Administrators to identify more top women candidates, which I think is laudable in this situation, because there are not enough women in Division I-A athletic director positions. And at that point, Julie Herman's resume then rose quickly to the top, and she quickly became one of two finalists, the other being Sean Frazier, who is the deputy athletics director at the University of Wisconsin. So my sense is they felt they were running out of time, and why they felt they had to operate before June 1st, I'm just not clear on.
Well, and there was also something that I read, and maybe one or both of you are familiar with this, that the questioning process for Julie Herman was very different than it was for Frazier, to the point where someone sent Frazier a letter and said, hey, we apologize for the hostile tone of the conversation, if that's how you felt it was.
Yes, right? Absolutely. Tyler Clemente, the institute, which was just named in the honor of the Rutgers student who killed himself over alleged video taking of his by his roommate has created another level of sensitivity on the Rutgers campus around LGBTQ issues as well as around bullying issues. So understandably so, they wanted to be sure that the next athletic director had a sensibility to this. But why one candidate was only grilled and the other candidate wasn't is up for discussion, I believe.
So, Steve, in the midst of all of this, Rutgers is in the process of joining the Big Ten. What does this tell us about the university's readiness to take a step like that?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I think that the Big Ten, by all appearances, is you know, hasn't wavered in its commitment, its plans to bring Rutgers on board. There's, you know, I think that in some ways it's you know, college conferences, you know, exist to help set up scheduling and to, you know, as a financial footing with television contracts and things of that nature. And so that a school that is potentially, you know, that is planning to join the conference is working out internal issues like this one, you know, in some ways you could say it looks like, you know, any other number of schools, you know, even in the Big Ten in recent years, you've had issues at Penn State, of course, you've had issues at Ohio State, you've had, you know, sanctions elsewhere. So, you know, that Rutgers is having, you know, issues that it's needing to address and the, you know, the public scrutiny of it wouldn't necessarily, you know, disqualify it from you know, joining the Big Ten in any way. But certainly it's, you know, the Big Ten, you know, may, you know, I don't know how it actually will, you know, ultimately play out, but I think that it seems that the Big Ten is going to stick with Rutgers for this.
Yeah, and I'd like to add to that, Steve. I think that's a great point. I'd also like to add that I see conferences evolving into more branding entities more than scheduling entities. And I do think that this is on Jim Delaney, the commissioner of the Big Ten Conference's radar. He did indicate yesterday that he felt it was a local issue. He did not need to get involved. But by that token, this will impact the Big Ten brand. So they are paying close attention to exactly what that means.
Steve, a couple quick things because we only have a few more minutes with you. There has been a call from some quarters for Tim Pernetti to come back to Rutgers. Have you heard anything about that, or is it at all likely?
Well, two good questions. I think the yes, there certainly have been calls for Tim Pernetti to come back, and my understanding is that within that 28-member committee that was advising President Barchi on who to bring back, that there was some quarters of that were saying, let's bring Tim Pernetti back. The internal discussions were that that's just not a plausible you know, solution to the athletic director issue. That came up also, to be sure, that came up during the process before the hiring of Julie Herman, but that drumbeat, I think, does continue. There are people out there that feel that Tim Pernetti shouldn't have been, you know, in a situation where he had to resign as a result of this, that he was good for the university and that he should be brought back. How plausible is that happening remains to be seen. You know, it would be a great question and, you know, probably something different than's happened elsewhere to see someone actually resign from a post like that and then come back. That would be a tough transition and pretty unusual, but hey, who knows?
Stranger things have happened at this point, right?
Sure.
Is there any thought that perhaps Dr. Barchi might change his mind about this hire?
Well, the headlines today, I think, are, you know, that I see on just now that, you know, Julie Herman's schedule is to be released. She's expected on campus soon. She's supposed to officially take her job on June 17th. So there isn't a sense at this point that Julie Herman, that something's going to derail Julie Herman from taking over the position. But, you know, this has been one of these news cycles where the stories have continued, and you know, obviously there's more time between now and June 17th, so we'll see and be looking at the stories closely.
Well, Steve, Rutgers has given you a lot to write about over the last few weeks, and we will continue to watch as these stories develop. Thank you, Steve Eder, for being with us here on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Steve is a reporter for the New York Times who focuses on college sports. We'll be talking about Rutgers and the business of college sports when Radio Times comes right back.
The Mann Center supports WHYY and presents Pixar in concert with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra June 27th, featuring scenes from Toy Story, The Incredibles, Finding Nemo, Up, Brave, and more on giant screens with a live orchestra and fireworks. Pixar in concert with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, June 27th at The Mann. Tickets are available at manncenter.org or at 215-893-1999. Presentation licensed by Disney Concert Library.
As another blockbuster Superman movie is about to appear, we were wondering, why is a 75-year-old character still this franchise?
Superman is magic. Superman is a modern American archetype.
The Man of Steel, new yet again at 75, next time in Studio 360's American Icons from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Penn supports WHYY. Do you frequently walk into a room and immediately forget why? Do you need to write things down to remember them? Is multitasking harder than it used to be? If this sounds familiar, you may qualify for a research study focusing on cognition and memory in menopausal women. The Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness is seeking women between the ages of 48 and 60 to participate in research to study the effects of certain hormones and medication on cognition in peri- and postmenopausal women. For more information, 215-41-STUDY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowane. We are talking about the events that have been happening at Rutgers in the last couple of months. There have been just a number of issues that have arisen within the athletic department. Some people would go so far as to call them scandals that have taken place. And of course, the most recent one has been about the hiring of the new athletic director, Julie Herman, and the information that came to light shortly thereafter about some lawsuits against her from other schools, about a letter from some of the athletes that she coached at one of those schools who claimed that she was abusive verbally to them. And so there's been much discussion and many headlines as a result of that. So we're talking about not only what has been taking place at Rutgers, but the business side of college sports, which is a story in itself. And here to help us do that is Dr. Karen Weaver. She is professor of sport management at Drexel. She's also a former coach and athletic director, so she brings a wealth of background to this discussion. We'd love to hear from you as well. Perhaps you are involved in collegiate athletics. You are the parent of someone who is either a college student or a student athlete. Whatever the case, we'd love to hear from you. And the number to join in our conversation is 888-477-9499. Karen Weaver, I want to go back a little bit to finish up the conversation that we were having with Steve Eder just a few minutes ago from the New York Times. And that was about Julie Herman and what's next for her. And he was saying that she's got some meetings scheduled, I think this week on campus, and she's expected to start her job the 17th. All of which raises the question, how effective can she be at this point in light of everything that has transpired?
Well, certainly there are a lot of stakeholders that will have a say and will want to ask Julie Herman themselves exactly who she is and what she stands for, and they'll want to size her up, and that's only fair. One of the things that I'm concerned about, having been on the inside of athletics departments, is how effectively her staff is going to work with and for her. They do know that she's the boss, but sometimes you've actually got to have a real sense of that your boss is leading you in the right direction. So she's going to need to establish herself early and be very consistent with her message across, and then be able to deliver some early wins for the department, and that will include some fundraising objectives.
That's always important.
Absolutely.
Dr. Barchi has, and I want to say right from the outset of this part of our conversation that Radio Times made several attempts to contact Rutgers to invite them to be part of this discussion, and we did not hear back. So what we're working with at this point is the statements that they have posted online. And in Dr. Barchi's statement in particular, he said that he, you know, still gives his full support to Julie Herman. And we're also seeing that even though Dr. Barchi has come under fire for the decision-making process, there are a number of former governors, as well as current governor Chris Christie, who have pledged their support to Dr. Barchi at this point. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's appropriate that the governor not get involved in an athletic director hiring. Otherwise, he's going to be in charge of hiring every dean on that campus, and that's just too unwieldy. But I do think he made a strong statement and come out in support of President Barchi. He feels that Barchi is the right man to lead Rutgers through a multifaceted transformation. This is just not an athletics issue for Dr. Barchi. It's also a medical school issue, which is extremely important. However, you cannot not pay attention to athletics. And we know that oftentimes in our field, they call it the front porch of the university, but it is the lens in which many people do view your university, and you need to pay attention to it.
Well, and let's talk about that for a moment, because a lot of the reason that Dr. Barchi is here, and certainly his top priority as an administrator, has been the merger of the medical schools with Rutgers, correct?
Correct, yes. And his background was, he was obviously president of Thomas Jefferson here in Philadelphia, and prior to that was provost at the University of Pennsylvania. And those are two excellent, excellent colleges, but neither one of them has a very high-level profile athletics program to the level that Rutgers currently has and aspires to be. So I'm not sure that Dr. Barchi had the same sensitivity that someone who would have been a president previously at a land-grant institution might have understood.
And you can't ignore, Karen, the political implications of something like this when you have someone who has a medical background, who is hired largely for the purpose of creating a medical merger, and all that that can mean to Rutgers University, that you would expect that there would be political support.
There needs to be, particularly if this is something that's being orchestrated at the highest levels of New Jersey government. One of the things that I tracked on the other day was the fact that Moody's, which is an investor bond rating organization that issues the ratings for Rutgers, actually downgraded Rutgers based on this initial kind of problem with athletics, because they feel like publicly it may impact their ability to recruit and retain students, and of course that's where your revenues come from. So Rutgers has got to track on that just for that issue alone, as they want to make sure they can borrow at the lowest possible rates.
Yeah. There has been a school of thought that has developed about college presidents and whether they even ought to be involved with athletics, whether they ought to be managing athletics, particularly at the D1 level, where it's a lot more complex than, say, a D2 or D3. What have you heard about that, and what do you think about that?
Well, the person who's probably been most vocal about that has been the president at University of North Carolina, Holden Thorpe, who has endured his own academic scandal in the last 2 years involving student-athletes on his campus. He is stepping down to become a provost at Washington University, which is a Division III school. And his sense is, I'm glad, because this business of Division I athletics has gotten to be too big and too unwieldy. Hunter Rawlings, who is the president of the AAU organization, the elite group of academic research institutions, just came out and said that athletics is one of the five major challenges facing college presidents at this level that they must deal with. And I couldn't agree with that more. They come in ill-prepared, thinking that athletics will be somewhat of an issue. Holden Thorpe, the UNC chancellor, came out and said, I spent most of my time dealing with athletics.
Wow. Well, and you look at a case like Penn State, right, and Graham Spanier, and I think for many college presidents, they feel that they can leave that to the people in the athletics department, and they can trust their subordinates to work these things out and sort of maintain an arm's length approach to this.
Well, it's interesting because that viewpoint contradicts with what the NCAA says that presidents ought to be doing. They say that presidents are in charge of their campuses and therefore are ultimately held responsible for the conduct of their athletics programs on their campuses. So really, presidents need to be more engaged, if anything else, but that problem is they're being pulled out in so many different directions for fundraising, for leading mergers, for growing their campuses, changing their campuses' identities, that it's really hard for one person to do all these jobs.
And so does that then raise a question of changing the way that college presidents are hired, looking for a different type of individual that has that background, or do we take that responsibility away to some degree, or what are your thoughts about what we can take away from what we're seeing?
Well, I think part of this falls on the boards who hire presidents and them being fully vetted and vested in understanding what the dynamics are. Yes, they may need to do one particular thing when they come in, as was the case with Dr. Barchi coming in for Rutgers, but there are always going to be other multitude of issues that are going to come up, and they've got to be equally skillful in dealing with that. So part of that is in their vetting process.
Yeah. Let's talk about the money issue, because inevitably that comes up when we're talking about college sports and the pressure that not just Rutgers, but so many universities feel to maximize their athletic departments.
Absolutely. We call it the arms race. And when you look at schools like the University of Texas, whose annual athletics budget is $125 million a year, and they are self-sustaining, you get an idea of exactly how much revenues they've got to be able to create every single year just to maintain that. So it is a huge challenge.
Wow. So the bar is set so high that there's just no choice.
And it's amazing. You think about Texas being a Division I institution, and we have five or six Division I institutions right here in Philadelphia whose athletic budgets combined may approach Texas's $125 million. Yeah.
Well, and then I've been reading about how the per-athlete spending right, has so grossly outpaced the per student spending for academics in so many of these schools. Give us a sense of what's going on there.
Yeah, my colleagues Scott Herko, Jeff Orleans, and Welch Suggs from the Knight Commission just did a really tremendous study outlining where this money is going. And in the last 7 years of the recession, college athletic spending per student athlete has gone from 4 to as much as 12 times more than the typical student. So if I'm spending $100 on a student on my campus, a typical student, I'm spending $1,200 on that student athlete.
What does that tell us?
It tells us that the arms race is a little out of control, and somehow we've got to get a handle on it. Now, some of this is factored in with coaches' salaries, and it's particularly in the high-profile sports. We are now paying football coaches and basketball coaches multi-million-dollar salaries. But other things come in facilities, and they come in travel budgets, and they come in some of the other opportunities that athletes are given with academic support and with additional strength coaches. And we have multitudes of directors of operations now, so we've staffed up these programs pretty heavily too.
Well, and universities have made these decisions based on the revenue that these programs generate.
Yep, they feel confident that the revenues are going to continue to come in, and conference commissioners of the big five or six conferences have gotten very skillful at driving in new revenues from television deals, college conference, television networks. So the fastest run of money that's been coming into colleges in the last 5 years has been from television.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that too, about the television piece of it and how that changes the game in terms of the money that's exchanged.
It really does, because there's two revenue streams that exist in cable television these days. There's the per subscriber fees, and then there's also the advertising rate. So it gives folks like ESPN and the Big Ten Network a major leg up over other broadcasters because they're able to offer so much more up front in terms of guaranteed revenue. And we now have several college conference networks. We have the Big Ten Network. We have the Pac-12 Network. The Southeastern Conference just announced they're going to do their own network. University of Texas has their own network. It's called the Longhorn Network. You know, and ACC and some other schools have talked about that too. And when you're talking about the reasons why Maryland and Rutgers joined the Big Ten Conference was they're projecting that each school could receive by 2017 almost $40 million a year just from the television revenue. You can see why they jumped into it.
Oh, my. And at the same time, and tuitions are still going up.
Yes.
Right? Karen, it begs the question, are we approaching a tipping point here? I mean, how sustainable is this? When you look at tuition being on the rise, you look at the per athlete spending being on the rise, particularly at these D1 schools and schools in the South probably in particular, where does this end?
Well, and it's an interesting dichotomy because of the way the system is set up and the fact that the student athletes don't receive anything more than the full cost of attendance to go to school there. They don't get paid in the typical way that you and I think of people getting paid. The money has to squirt out somewhere, so it ends up being put into facilities. It ends up being put up into coaches' salaries and other kinds of things. The question becomes, though, why doesn't some of that money get redirected back to the academic side of the house? And I think some presidents have been hesitant to do that for two reasons. Number one, because they fear losing a competitive advantage. If they do it and nobody else does, they're stuck on an island. They need some uniformity in that decision. And then secondly, they're also afraid that the athletic department will then start running the university because they're the primary revenue source for the university, or they become one of the major revenue sources for the university. We've been comfortable with medical schools doing that because they've generated research dollars, but are we as comfortable with athletics programs doing that?
Well, and we saw a little bit of that at Penn State, correct?
Yes, very much so. Yeah. Absolutely. Football was a major economic engine and still is for State College.
Yeah. So what has the pushback been like when you think about faculty who have to be looking at this, particularly at the D1 schools, and saying, wait a minute, students are coming here to get an education. We're providing that education. How is it that the spending is 12 times as much for an athlete as it is for a student?
And meanwhile, my classroom has more students in it than ever, and my technology needs haven't caught up. And by the way, nobody on the faculty has gotten a raise in 5 years. And there is that there's always been tension between athletics and academics for as long as we've had intercollegiate sports. That's a given. But the constant tension to continually increase spending on the athletic side really concerns faculty members, and rightfully so.
Yeah. So is there some movement in that direction? Have faculty been taking action at some of these schools to try to bring about some sort of change, or to bring about at least a better degree of balance?
Well, Rutgers in particular had a very vocal group a few years ago who was concerned at the amount of money that Rutgers was investing in football back when Greg Schiano was the coach. They invested, I believe, $102 million into their football stadium back then. And they were concerned that Rutgers was trying to be something bigger than it was. They knew it as a good academic institution, but they really weren't quite happy with where they were trying to place the football program. So they're probably actually one of the leading voices in this.
Hmm. And do you expect that we'll hear more about that, that this is something that's going to gain steam over time?
I think there's a lot out there already about it, and certainly if you find pockets, the University of Massachusetts faculty were very upset that they moved their football program to the highest competitive level and are now playing their games 92 miles away in Foxborough, Massachusetts at the New England Patriots football stadium. So they don't even have on-campus football anymore at the University of Massachusetts. They moved it 90 miles to the east. Other schools, like University of California and Berkeley, just invested $356 million into upgrading their football stadium that's already built on an earthquake fault, but they wanted to retrofit it so that it was stronger and more stable. And they're saying at a time when California universities are desperate for funding, we're spending $350 million on a football stadium.
Yeah, that's got to raise some eyebrows for sure.
It certainly did.
Let me invite our listeners to join us in our conversation. We have been talking about Rutgers and the events that have been taking place there in the last 2 months. There have been a number of issues that have arisen in the athletics department in particular. There have been hirings and firings that have been controversial there, but also talking about the business of college sports, and it is big business indeed. We welcome you to join in our conversation. We're talking with Dr. Karen Weaver from Drexel. She is a sport management professor there and also is a former coach and athletic director in her own right. The number to call is 888-477-9499. Karen, I want to circle back to a point that you made earlier in our conversation. We were talking about women in these management positions, and I suspect that maybe that's something that you talk about with your students. And Julie Herman would be one of what, three or four athletic directors?
There's only two others. Debbie Yao, who is the athletic director at North Carolina State, and Sandy Barber, who is the athletic director at California Berkeley.
How is it that there are only now three women athletic directors nationwide?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And that's the question that a lot of women have been asking themselves, is they want that opportunity to step up and be in the chair, if you speak. And yet what happens is something like this, and it makes some women think to themselves, do I really want to take that risk? Maybe I'm better off being the number two, because it's a really tough spotlight in the number one. But there are many, many, many qualified women who can do this job and need to be considered for this job.
You said that there were not many women in the running at Rutgers. Were there other women who were considered for that position?
Not that I'm aware of. My sense is that the search firm did not undercover a number of women. They only undercovered maybe a couple of women, and yet they did not find out about Julie Herman until after they called the National Association of Collegiate Women Athletic Administrators, which is shocking to me in that she was the past president of the association. So that does tell me, you know, you need to look a little bit deeper in your vetting process.
Well, and it sounds, I mean, they really had to search just to come up with that one name.
It harkens back to the Romney comment, I need binders and binders full of women.
And Karen, what does that tell us, that there are so few at this point? 2013.
Yeah, absolutely. And it tells us that people are very concerned about revenue producing, and they want to go with folks who are proven revenue producers. And many times women have not gotten themselves into those positions where they're counted on to raise significant revenues, and that's going to be an important trend.
I want to talk to you more about that trend when we come back, because we are about to take a quick break. But we are talking about Rutgers University and some of the problems that have cropped up in the athletics department over the last 2 months. We're also talking about the business of college sports, and we would love to hear from you at 888-477-9499. Radio Times will be right back right after this.
Longwood Gardens supports WHYY. On Friday, June 7th, Longwood Gardens presents Peter Yarrow and Noel Paul Stuckey in the Open Air Theater. These Grammy winners are celebrating the 50th anniversary of Peter, Paul, and Mary and carry on the tradition of the folk singing trio by performing their classic hits. Longwood Gardens, nestled in the heart of the Brandywine Valley in Chester County. There are limited tickets for this concert, available online at longwoodgardens.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Attorney General Eric Holder remains under fire for his department's role in seizing phone records of journalists. Is it time for Holder to resign? Also, remembering one of our favorite guests, musician Rob Morseberger. He died over the weekend. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase offers lung screening for individuals at high risk of lung cancer. Based on results of a national trial which showed death from lung cancer was reduced by 20% with early detection. Qualified candidates receive a low-dose CT scan and an appointment with an advanced practice clinician to discuss the results that same day. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We've been talking about the events at Rutgers over the last 2 months, particularly in the athletics department and the hiring of the new athletic director, Julie Herman, who has come under fire for some lawsuits and some letters that came out after her hiring. We're also talking about the business of college sports, the levels of money that are involved, and also about some of the trends that we're seeing and the fact that there have been relatively few, very few women at the highest levels of college athletics, Julie Herman now becoming one of them. Our guest is Dr. Karen Weaver. She's a professor of sport management at Drexel University. She was at Penn State Abington as well. She's a former coach and athletic director too, and so we've been going through these issues. We invite you to join our conversation at 888-477-9499. Karen, when we left off, we were talking about the fact that there are, that Julie Herman now becomes one of three female athletic directors in the country, and just the search process even to get her name in the mix. I had to wonder, as I was thinking about this, do women coaches, and you can speak from your own experience, is there a pressure to behave differently, to maybe emulate what some of the male coaches do in order to feel that they're being taken seriously? I mean, what kind of dynamics are going on there that would cause a female coach to feel that, hey, I've got to be somebody different in this role?
Well, I think some of it is a challenge that all coaches feel at that level. The money has gotten so powerful, and the incentive to turn coaches over because of the lack of winning has gotten so pervasive that coaches internalize that pressure almost immediately. And I'll use an example of a colleague of mine at a university who said she can't walk down the hallway without passing a national championship trophy or a conference championship trophy just from her non-revenue sport peers or her Olympic sport peers. Her pressure then internalized is, I need to deliver on this. Yeah. I need to be as, otherwise I'm not the same ilk as my wrestling coach down the hall or as my soccer coach, you know, upstairs who's won a national championship.
So it's almost like being in a corporate environment, right, where you're, say, in sales and you've got to justify your existence every day.
Absolutely.
Or there's somebody waiting in the wings to take your job.
Absolutely. Yeah. And these contracts are designed to be broken and coaches can be let go. And they're very much viewed as a commodity that can be interchanged. And that pressure adds to the need to succeed.
Yeah. We've got a number of people who want to join in our conversation here, Karen. So let's go to the phones and we'll start off in Hackettstown, New Jersey with Dan. Welcome, Dan, to Radio Times.
Hi, yes. I'd like to just bring up the kind of shifting of money away from less popular and less money-generating sports such as fencing and crew, particularly in the case of Rutgers, where they cut funding from those programs and downgraded them from Div 1A to club sports a few years ago. Crew at Rutgers is extremely well-known, extremely respected, had quite a few Olympic-level competitors from the crew team at Rutgers. Fencing was similar. It was also had the highest GPA of any varsity sport. And they cut all the funding from that and very much damaged those very well-known, very well-respected programs. and just commenting that it seems like a big shame to lose out on programs that may not generate as much money but bring a lot of respect and a lot mm-hmm. of other important, I think, abilities to the school. Take my comments up there. Thanks very much.
Thanks for your call, Dan.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great point. Rutgers had a very difficult time in announcing a number of sports that were cut a few years ago. Interestingly enough, the day that Maryland announced they were joining the Big Ten, there was a lot of questions because Maryland had announced they were just dropping about six or seven sports. And the number one question was, are you now going to bring those sports back? Mm. Because in the past, they've been able to say, we just simply don't have the revenues. Well, now if you've got all these new revenues at this coming in, then what's that going to mean for the new sports that want to come back to the table?
All right, we'll go next to Louisville, Kentucky, and we'll bring Ian into our conversation. Hi there, Ian.
Yes, I see Julie Herman around the Louisville campus, and I know she's a mother of young children, and I believe the news reported that two incidents are one coach became pregnant and got terminated, and a coach at Louisville was a female on the track team and the coaching staff and trying to get a difficult situation resolved, and she went to Herman and then to HR. And I'm just wondering about comments. Do you think Julie Herman's like the professor at Princeton who wrote the newspaper article or magazine article about you can't have it all, and she's sort of in the spotlight because she's trying to do that?
Well, thank you, Ian. That raises an interesting question, I think, about women trying to have it all and sort of being told at some point that that was possible. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think in this business of athletics, intercollegiate athletics is a 24/7, 365 business, and it's a very competitive business. So it makes it easy for workaholics to thrive in this business. So I think it's more challenging when you're trying to have some sort of balance in your life, whether it be with your family or anything else. But it does seem to reward those who want to devote 24/7, 365 to it, no doubt.
And the lawsuit that Ian brought up was the one involving a staff member who, I guess the allegation was that Julie Herman discouraged her from becoming pregnant.
Her assistant coach, evidently, who had worked with her for a number of years, was excited about getting married, excited about starting a family, and it appears that Julie was dissuading her from doing that because she was worried about her work output at the office.
We'll go to Ardmore next, and Tim. Hi, Tim. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I kind of have a question about this sort of foundational myth about enhancing these university programs. They put so much money into them, and it seems to be that the line they give is this somehow enhances or we'll get better students or we'll get more students to this university because we have these great sports programs. But there's an emerging body of literature that's saying that this just is not true, that this is a myth about student enrollment, that sports programs don't enhance student enrollments and they don't improve students that come to these campuses with these huge, expensive sports programs. And I'm wondering whether your guests could comment on that, whether this is something that is true or whether this is a myth.
Thank you, Tim.
Tim, that's a great point. I'm so glad you brought that up. There is a body of work that's evolving out of this issue around big-time college sports and whether it attracts and retains students. And what we're seeing is that it does a very good job of getting the university's name out there. We can agree on that. It also does a very good job of generating applications. We can agree on that. What we have not been able to agree on is whether there is actually success in retaining students and graduating them over 4 years. A colleague of mine, Murray Sperber, wrote a book a couple of decades ago now called Beer and Circus, What Life is Like on an Undergraduate Campus. And a lot of folks seem to think that people gravitate to these schools for the party-like atmosphere that exists on football Saturdays and on football weekends. So whether they are, in fact, there to be academics or that they're just there to have a good time is up for debate. But I do think you can make the case that you're not attracting the best and the brightest students, but you're attracting a larger number of students.
Mm. Well, and isn't there something to be said, though, Karen, for that, in the sense that for any student, regardless of their academic prowess, that there is a certain appeal about that being part of the college experience, right? The football games, all the energy on campus, all of those kinds of things that is, to some degree, an attraction.
No question, and it's unique to the American system. Nowhere else in the world do you get this kind of experience with college sports and the passion that exists around college sports, and it's the one event that actually connects us to our university in so many different ways. But unfortunately, and some campuses, is has gotten a little bit too extreme when you've got a Thursday night football game to see campuses closing Thursday classes to allow for off-campus parking and RVs to come in. Then you wonder, where is the priority on this?
Yeah, are we not moving in a direction that is not going anywhere good in the end?
Exactly.
Yeah. Let me invite our listeners to join us. We're talking about the business of college sports. The number is 888-477-9499. Karen Weaver, as a professor in this area at Drexel, what are some of the lessons that you and your students are taking away from what you've been seeing at Rutgers over the last couple of months?
Well, I mean, the media certainly covered the idea of doing a thorough job of vetting and things like that. But I also think there's an opportunity here for Rutgers that I'd like to mention. And I'm kind of surprised they haven't launched on it. They were obviously very hurt by what happened with Tyler Clemente. So they took the initiative to start their LGBTQ center, which was a tremendous idea. I think Rutgers could really take the stand and become a national leader in positive coaching. And they could really ask their coaching staff to become model positive coaches and really be able to make a statement to parents of future student athletes. We can guarantee this is how your son or your daughter will be treated when they come here to play. And they could really become a national leader in how to coach in a very positive, self-affirming manner, which I think we need more of that, especially when we're demonstrating to youth coaches how to coach.
Yeah. What would be the steps required to do that? What are some of the things that Rutgers would have to do in order to get to that level?
Well, you know, as in anything else, as Penn State has done, Penn State has tried to really take on a national role in child abuse and be much more aware of it. You could start by hosting conferences. There are a number of positive coaching alliances. There's the Josephson School for Ethics that could start to have some of their national conferences on the campus, so you can open up the dialogue, invite the media to have more of a discussion about this, because this business of bullying coaching is not limited to college sports. It is very much an issue within youth sports, and people seem to think that ranting and raving and throwing a clipboard is good coaching, and it is not. Yeah. So helping people understand what good coaching looks like, I think Rutgers could really be a leader in this.
You know, Karen, I think that for a while that was considered almost cute, that whole, you know, the Bobby Knight thing.
Yes.
Early on, that
yes.
It was, there was a cuteness to it, and there was, oh, that's just, you know, how he does things, and there were results, and so, you know, people thought that, hey, maybe that's the way to do it, because he's winning ball games, right?
Exactly. It was A equals B type of thing. But if you think about it, and you said, you know, you're the parent of children who are in college or going to college, is that how you want your son or daughter treated? And it certainly wouldn't be how I would want my children treated. And I would want them treated with respect. And hopefully they're being treated with respect in the classroom and on the field.
Yeah. Have you looked at the effects on some of the student athletes who have had coaches like this? Is there any literature yet that tells us what the long-term effects are of having a coach who has been abusive, whether it's physically, verbally, that sort of thing?
There hasn't been as much as there should be, but there have been occasionally, you know, athletes that have spoken up about the kinds of abuse, and generally they've been isolated and outcasted from their team, so it's been an uncomfortable situation to talk about.
Yeah. Well, and I found it was interesting that this letter that the volleyball team, I guess it was,
right.
Composed. And that letter was written right at the time that she was coaching them, correct?
That's what I don't think there was a date on it, but that's what the players say.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that there was just, they talked about being traumatized by what they experienced.
Very much so. And, you know, this level of coaching in Division I is so intense and so insular that it's really easy for student athletes to reflect all that energy back on each other, which adds to the traumatic experience they were going through.
Yeah. So in our last couple of minutes, Karen, just wanted to talk about, you know, what are the lessons? I know that you're talking about your students with all of this, but for other universities, particularly D1, who are watching what's been happening at Rutgers, and we're talking not just about, you know, the athletics, though that's a huge piece of it. You know, when you look at the basketball issues, Mike Rice, Jordan, the new coach, and the whole issue of, you know, oh, oops, he didn't have a degree after all. The lacrosse coach who was suspended for a time. These sort of blunders that have happened one after the other. What are some of the takeaways that other universities can get from the Rutgers experience?
Well, I think that the number one takeaway is that presidents must be more involved. They cannot shirk their responsibilities. Mm-hmm. They must set the tone from the top as to what their expectation is to how people treat each other on their campuses. And that's certainly something that Rutgers needs to become more forthcoming about as far as the even level of respect that students and professors and coaches have for each other. That's the first one. The secondly is that athletic directors, yes, they can be very focused on external fundraising, but ultimately they're in charge of 500 to 1,000 student athletes a year on their campuses. So what are they going to lay down in terms of the expectations from their coaches?
Yeah.
And finally, I think that coaches themselves have got to realize that these 18 to 22-year-olds are kids who are very much enamored with the coach and will listen and do almost whatever the coach says to do. And you have to be really respectful and mindful of that power position you hold.
Is there a lesson, too, for university administrators about not themselves becoming starstruck about, you know, not only the athletes, but some of these big-name coaches who come into the programs?
Absolutely. And that's something when you work in athletics for years, if you don't get over that quickly, you're not going to last very long in the profession. You cannot let yourself get overwhelmed with somebody's salary or their aura when they walk in the room, and you cannot let the boosters drive the discussion. That's a really important lesson for presidents to know.
Yeah. What are you going to be watching for as you continue to teach and just to research this and talking with your colleagues? What kinds of developments are you going to be watching for as it relates to the business of college sports?
Well, I keep looking for Rutgers to step out front and take a leadership on something like this, and I'm hoping they will take a leadership and try to step up and say, yes, we have made some mistakes, but we can be a national leader in such as this, and the positive coaching would certainly be a great step because I'm not aware of any other institutions that have done that.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see if they're able to make that transition and how long it will take, because right now there's a lot of work to do, just I would think immediately in terms of regaining trust.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That internal staff meeting that Julie Herman will have initially and then with each senior staff member will be very important, and she'll have to set a tone that allows them to start to begin to trust her.
Yeah. And there's a lesson in that, I think, just for athletic directors, for university personnel, just about setting that tone from the very beginning.
Absolutely.
Right?
And President Barchi will need to be right at her side and make sure that he supports her every step of the way.
Yeah, and knowing that the videotape may be running, so you've got to be careful.
Exactly right.
Well, we have been talking about the events at Rutgers, particularly in the athletics department. We've also been talking about the very complicated business of college sports. There is so much money involved, particularly for D1 schools, and that in itself has been a game changer, to use a pun, as to what has been happening in college athletics and why we are seeing some of the issues that we have been seeing. I want to take this moment to thank you, Dr. Karen Weaver, for being with us on Radio Times and helping us to get a better understanding of some of the nuances and some of the things that universities are contending with as it relates to college sports. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
You have been listening to Radio Times on WHYY, and I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane.